Tonight on the History Channel, where is the magical and mystical Ark of the Covenant? How did Axum save Islam from cult oblivion? Could the legendary Queen of Sheba have come from Axum? And who built the iconic Axumite stele? Was it people and elephants? Or could it have been an ancient alien civilization? Find out tonight on...
Countries that don't exist anymore. They used to exist, but not anymore. Now you know what this podcast is for. It's countries that don't exist anymore.
Well, welcome to Countries That Don't Exist Anymore, another episode we've got that's happening literally now. Before we crack on with our special guest for this examination of the Axumite Empire, don't forget that we've got all our socials that you can follow at CTDEAPod on the Twitter, on the Facebook, CTDEAPod@gmail.com. Send us an email, ask us a question, send us some abuse. We really don't mind. Anyway, this week we've got another expert.
Yes, we certainly
branching
have.
Out to the world of experts.
Shall I introduce our expert?
Yes,
Phil?
Do it now.
Okay, I will do it. Now, our guest today is a bona fide Axum expert. As an archaeologist, she's been digging holes from Crete to Sudan, but is an Ethiopian specialist. She's a globe-trotting lecturer, helped to create an Axum museum with the Ethiopian Heritage Conservation Project, and is currently a research affiliate at SOAS, the School of Oriental and African Studies. And talking of long acronyms, please welcome to CTDEA, Countries That Don't Exist Anymore, Dr. Jackie Phillips.
Woo! Welcome, 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 welcome.
Thank you for coming on.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yeah, it's really great to have an archaeologist actually on the show, because I've always been a little bit envious of archaeologists. Maybe that's a sort of grass is greener or desert is sandier or whatever else thing. But it's when I was studying history, very interesting though it was, I always felt like I was just sort of reading lots of people's opinions and analysis and whatever, and then sort of regurgitating it and refitting it to my own argument. But I didn't feel like, and that was, you know, brilliant, I've always loved that stuff, but I didn't feel like with archaeologists I always had the sense that you guys are finding new things, you're at the sort of forefront of discovery, and that for me is really that's a brilliant and enviable thing to do with your life. Is it up to the hype?
It's up to the hype. You don't get paid very much often. You don't get paid at all, but I mean, I like to term it, it's Christmas every day.
Oh, that's nice.
Simply because you get something new, you know, every day. I don't actually dig. I work with the finds. They get dirty. They bring the stuff to me and I work with it. So, you know, I'm actually cleaning the stuff and studying it. And so to me, it's Christmas every day because everything is new.
How often are you off somewhere on a dig, and how much of the year are you back here?
It depends. It depends. Some years it's... can be as short as, say, 2 months or so. Sometimes, depending on how many digs I go on, it could be as much as 4 or 5 even. It doesn't happen very often. And it all depends on funding, because, you know, how long you stay depends on how much money you've got to work with. And this year, of course, there's nothing. So
Yeah.
Probably next year as well, but we live in hope.
The point, I guess, in some respects is what archaeologists are able to do is to sort of piece together gaps in our knowledge. And obviously, you know, but also create whole new avenues for us to go down, which we weren't aware was there previously. And also in the case of Axum, of course, is piecing together something that in some ways has been lost, or to a great degree lost. Because look, when we've been looking into Axum, we've sort of discovered, you know, we were amazed by what kind of a superpower it was in its day. And yet, I mean, we know that it was compared to Rome, Persia, and China, and yet it might as well not have existed.
Yeah.
From when I was growing up, I mean, I'd never really heard of it.
I never heard of it until we did this episode.
Yeah, exactly.
No, so, I know. It's join the club. That's just about the rest of the world. There's very few of us who know very much at all about it. The reason is very simple. Ethiopia was never colonized. So you didn't have hordes of foreigners going in, organizing, administrating everything, digging up things and shipping them home, so that you didn't get things in museums. So nobody saw the material. So nobody really looked at it. The first real excavation was only about 110 years ago. The Germans came in, a man called Enno Littmann and his team of four, and they poked around, really. They recorded things above ground, mostly. Littmann himself was a linguist, and so he was interested in the texts. And Krenker, his architect, was interested in the buildings, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so mostly they were recording what was above ground because it really hadn't been recorded before. And they did some wall tracing. That's where you sort of dig a hole either side of the walls just to see where it goes. And they recorded what they found there. But they didn't really do much digging, and they didn't do any stratigraphical digging. You know, they most they had was deep layer, shallow layer, deepest layer, you know, and they only took about 250 objects back with them to Germany. And, you know, that was their study collection. Even today in Ethiopia, if it's archaeological, if it's an artifact, it doesn't leave the country. So everything that you find, you have to record while you're there. If you miss one measurement, for example, you won't be able to do anything for another year. Most countries now won't let you export anything. So it's all recording. The main reason is the lack of colonization and, quite frankly, the lack of interest. Most people were interested in the classical world, and Aksum was on the very, very fringe of it. Mostly what the classical authors and what the classical traders and soldiers and everyone did was they just stopped by at Ajulis, the port, and then moved on to India. You know, so they didn't actually get into the country all that much, at least in our records. I mean, people may have, we just don't know. We have one reference where, you know, there's a record, it's called the Periplus Maris Erythrae, the Periplus of the Erythraean Sea, where there's one mention when they come into Ajulis and they are bringing a little Roman money for the resident foreigners. Now, whether they are at Ajulis or further inland, we don't know, but that's the only reference we have to people not Aksumite, or rather classical, who are actually in the area. Another reason really is that most of the literature that's published is published in Ethiopic journals or in specialist journals that really doesn't travel to the outside world. About a year ago, I went to a conference where they asked me to talk about Aksum to late antique archaeology people. And I started out by saying, who here has heard of Aksum before today? Quite a number of people, you know, who's heard of Aksum, knows anything about it other than the stele? Hands went down, you know, anything a little more than the stele, and about two people had their hands up. And these are late antique archaeologists, you know, so it's just that it doesn't really go very far, which is really a pity because it's such a great civilization, a great empire. And like you said, you know, it was Mani in the mid third century who described it as being one of the four great empires that existed at his in his day, which is, you know, and comparable to Rome, Persia, and Seleos, which we think is China. We don't actually know, but we think is China. And that puts it into perspective. I mean, this is a Persian man who says Aksum is one of the four great empires of his day. Contrast it with modern day, where Neville Chittick, who excavated in the 70s, was basically an East Africanist archaeologist, but he moved up to Aksum to do something. And he basically said Aksum is the last great civilization of the ancient world to be revealed to modern knowledge. You know, people just haven't heard of it. And this is one thing he was trying to do. He died, unfortunately, before he was able to do it. And one of his people published the excavations. But that's why we went back in the 90s to do more with it, to finish the work that he did. That book plus ours right now, apart from Littmann's publication in 1913, are really the only major publications of fieldwork in Ethiopia yet. I mean, there's plenty of new excavations. They just haven't come out with the final publication yet. So it's really only us.
Well, speaking of that, you know, obviously I wouldn't say that Phil's subscribed to any archaeological journals, are you, Phil?
Well, not yet, but...
No, no, Netflix doesn't count, by the way. Just so you know.
Well, that case, definitely not.
Okay. Well, yes, we'll see about that. But I'm sure they'll get their...
I saw the Indiana Jones trilogy.
Yes, I mean, that doesn't count. That's not real archaeology. Because we don't have access to... or at least a lot of people listening to this won't really know what's going on. Seeing as, you know, you're an expert in this, is there any sort of really exciting finds or projects which are going on at the moment which might illuminate things?
Yes, there's several. I won't mention ours because we haven't published it yet, but there's a recent publication in Antiquity on a site called Beta Samati, and they've just discovered the earliest Christian basilica in Ethiopia.
Ooh, wow.
Fourth century.
Wow.
All the others that we know of probably aren't any earlier than the late fifth. And so this is really exciting because not only got Christian, he's excavated the site. This is Mike Harrower. You know, they've excavated the site, they've excavated the building, and what they found is not only an inscription that says, Christ be favorable to us, but also in the building, they found some nearly 50 little animal bull figurines and bucranias, sort of the horns, which are pagan. He's got a basilica that's both pagan and Christian.
Yeah, nice.
You know, there's only one short article as yet. This is really new stuff. And... It's really, really fantastic.
It is. I mean, what a find as well. You know,
waiting for him to do something more. And another one is something called the Garima Gospels. Now, Abba Garima is a monastery near Yehan, actually not that far away from Beta Samati, which is a living monastery. It's been in existence since late 5th, early 6th century. Up until 1950, nobody had seen these outside of Abba Garima. Three manuscripts, vellum manuscripts. One is later, but they are, all three of them are very classical in appearance. They're painted, they're written, they're like just about every classical Byzantine manuscript, gospels. But they're Ethiopic. They are written in Ge'ez, the local language, not in Greek. And they're wonderfully painted, and they're very classical in style. They're obviously derived from Greek originals, you know, the Ethiopic take on the Greek originals. But the important thing is these things are dated between 330 and 650 AD by carbon dating.
I mean, where were these found?
At Abba Garima. They've always been at Abba Garima.
Oh,
they've never left the monastery.
Oh my goodness, that's amazing.
You know, and like I said, the first non-Ethiopian to see them, probably non-monk at Abba Garima to see them, they only first saw it in 1950.
Well, I'm glad that monasteries somewhere are still keeping the tradition of preserving stuff. You know, that's incredible.
Oh, most of the oldest monasteries are have their own treasures.
Yeah.
And even the more modern ones have kept the treasures from the earlier buildings. So a lot of Ethiopian monastic foundations and churches have got their own treasures, and some of them are absolutely gorgeous. But the important thing with the Garima Gospels is that up until these things were carbon dated, it was thought that manuscript illumination did not start until the 13th century.
Oh, really?
AD. And it was thought originally that the Garima Gospels were that date as well, because they were quite clearly very early.
Mm.
But it was the C14 dating that really showed how early they were. And in fact, depending on that date range, as I said, 330 to 650 or so, if they're earlier than 586, which is the date written on a classical manuscript called the Rabula Gospels, at least one of them, if not both of them, are the earliest complete Christian manuscripts in the world.
Because
the Rabula Gospels were always acknowledged to be the earliest.
And also, wouldn't it be interesting to contrast them to the other Gospel-y manuscripts?
Oh, I see. Are you trying to unpick?
I'm trying to find out if Jesus got married.
Are you Dan Browning this conversation, are you?
I want to know if Jesus had a kid.
Yeah, the thing is, you see, that their date ties in very, very nicely with the date of the foundation of the monastery, because the monastery is founded by Abba Garima, surprisingly, who was one of the traditional nine saints who came and introduced monasticism to Ethiopia. Mm. He founded the monastery, and the nine saints are reputedly, at least traditionally, apparently arrived late 5th, early 6th century. And that was when he would have founded the monastery. So the date of the manuscripts ties in very well with the traditional date of the foundation of the monastery. And it also ties in very well with the fact that because it's written in Geuz, and it's they're so beautifully, beautifully painted, there had to have been a scriptorium there where they were producing these things. And in order for them to produce these things, they had to have Greek originals to work from. Otherwise, they wouldn't have had those very classical illustrations, which means before that, they had Greek texts, which obviously haven't survived. So the tradition has been there for some time before the Garima Gospels were created. They had to have been. Given that it was one of the nine saints, given that they came at about the time of a very well-known and a very religious king, he eventually retired to a monastery, he abdicated, named Caleb. They were traditionally were founded under his reign, which means that if they had these manuscripts, if they were producing these new manuscripts, these Geuz manuscripts, it means that Caleb was sufficiently powerful, sufficiently wealthy, or at least the kingdom was, to be able to support at least one scriptorium to produce these wonderful manuscripts, and probably others as well. So it was stable. The kingdom was stable. You know, the kingdom was wealthy. The kingdom had lots of resources to be able to support these scriptoria.
As you say, you can sometimes get a good clue of the power of a state, of its institutions, you know, by its works, by what it can produce. And whether that's here, or we've done one of our first episodes, actually, we were looking at Offa's Dyke and how that said something about the state of Mercia.
Listen to episode 1, Mercia, now.
Countries that don't exist anymore.
Beady-eared listeners will hear that the language is pronounced Geuz, is that right?
Geuz, yeah.
Geuz, okay.
There's an apostrophe
in between. Yeah, I said Geuz.
The king was Caleb. So if you want to go back and listen to our podcast and decide who got the right pronunciation, was it Dr. Jackie Phillips, a leading expert, or us with our Geuz and our Caleb?
I should say that leading experts all pronounce it differently anyway. That's how I
agree. That's exactly
it. So don't worry about it.
Perfect. Yeah, we made a whole geezer joke.
But I should point out also that the Geuz language is still the one that's used in the liturgy today in the Ethiopian church.
Ooh, so they must know how it's said.
Yes.
They must know how it's said, yeah. But actually, it's really only the priests and the liturgical people who actually can read and write and understand.
Yeah. Sort of like Latin,
Latin
today.
Modern. Yeah. Catholic Church, you know, it was used until 66.
Yeah.
But you know, most people didn't know actually what was being said.
I know, that's great. I think they ruined it by revealing what it actually meant. Mm. Kept it a mystery when you didn't know what they were saying.
That's
why everyone left.
So Gareth Jones, this ties in quite nicely because he says it seems that African Christianity gets ignored in a lot of histories, considering they were early adopters. In short, I know that we covered a little bit about this. You know, Frumentius of Tyre, said to be the founder of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, and obviously blimey, getting to all sorts of minefields of pronunciation. But also the other part of it is really interesting for people who are interested in their Byzantine history, because they deal with the issue of Monophysitism, and that's something which still exists. It seems like such an ancient argument, as all these things are. I don't know if you're up to speed on this, Phil, but just to get you up to speed, there's Chalcedon, the Council of Chalcedon.
Yes, Chalcedon and Anti-Chalcedon. Yeah,
that's right. And there was then a sort of division in opinion about how many natures Christ has, which may seem to us to be kind of a six of one and half a dozen the other, but obviously at the time they got very ill-tempered.
Oh,
about
they had
these
riots.
Things. Yeah, exactly.
They were riots.
So what were the options?
The options were that he had one nature, a divine nature, and that's monophysitism. And the other one, which was taken up by most other, which ended up to be
it's
the Orthodox
Catholic
position,
Church, basically.
Exactly,
that
he had human and divine.
Monophysite, the Catholic Church's diophysite.
Yeah.
okay, right.
I'm pronouncing those weird as well. I know.
There are things in common there with the Egyptian
church,
Coptic
Georgian
church,
etc. Yeah,
exactly.
It's part of the Eastern Church.
Yeah.
In fact, Frumentius was crowned the patriarch of, well, the metropolitan of Aksum, by the patriarch in Alexandria of the Coptic Church. So they were always, not always, but they were nominally at least under the authority of the Coptic Church. But you were saying about Aksum being an early advocate of Christianity. Well, to give it to you in terms of dates, Aksum was the fourth polity in the world to make Christianity its official religion.
Ooh, behind who?
The first one was Armenia in 301.
Uh-huh.
The second one was Georgia in 319. The third one was Rome in 325. And the fourth one was Aksum, probably somewhere between 350, 360 or so. I mean, we don't have an exact date for that one.
Yeah. So that's seriously early. And also, I was just putting pins in my mental map. That's quite a spread.
It is.
Yeah.
But like I said, it's officially Christian. It's not sort of Christianity. It's officially Christian. India did have Christians, you know, earlier than that already, but it wasn't officially Christian.
No, and again, we're getting back to, was it Dan Brown here? Obviously, as we all know, Jesus went on and died in India, and there we are.
Yeah.
So there
and
we
he
go.
Went to
that's,
America.
That's real historical fact.
I believe he went
that
to America
is,
after that.
Yeah, exactly. He sure did.
Had a war with the natives or something.
Countries don't exist anymore.
Was there sort of something like an Aksumite identity? You know, the Romans, for example, would think of themselves as Romans. Would the people
of
Aksum?
Well, we have absolutely no idea. Mm. You know, most of our records are either material goods, you know, pottery, glass, that sort of thing, or texts in one form or another, inscriptions, written texts. We have no written texts, you know, on paper, apart from things like the Garima Gospels, which are entirely religious. But the inscriptions that we have are all either religious or royal. You know, the king telling you how great he is and he did this and he conquered there and, you know, whatever else have you. And these are all my titles.
Showing off.
But we have nothing from the ordinary people at all. So we have no idea what they thought of themselves, although I would strongly suspect that they were quite proud of being Aksumite and their great power and their great kingdom and whatever else have you, because Ethiopia today is quite rightly very proud of its own heritage.
Yeah.
And I can't see that not being like that in Aksum at the time.
Is Ethiopia's heritage and identity, do they recognize Aksum as like their, do they have like a thing
of
like, this is our old great empire, wasn't it amazing kind of thing?
Yep.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sort of like the Italians today.
Have you seen any of the, you can look it up online. Take a look at some of YouTube's from when the Stela that was in Rome, Stela 2, came back to
Ethiopia. Of course.
Yeah.
I mean, huge crowds everywhere. Mind you, they were arriving in Tigray, which is particularly proud of it because that's where it was going. It was going to Aksum. But that was really, really big. During the war, you know, the Tigray People's Liberation Party had the Aksum Stela as its symbol. And what I found interesting, because I started working there in 85, shortly after the war ended. Sorry, 93, shortly after the war ended. And with all the fighting, Aksum itself was held by the government. And everything, all the countryside around was held by the rebels, by the party. And there were no bullet marks on any of the monuments. I mean, at Aksum Airport, there was a plane that had been shot down and it still had all the holes from the bullets. But the monuments themselves were untouched, which tells you, you know, how both sides of the conflict looked upon the monuments.
Mm. Well, that's incredible level of respect. But obviously, you say that speaks to how important it's held to individuals.
Indeed. But I guess neither side wants to be the one that riddled these amazing national monuments with bullets.
No, it's a shame that ISIS weren't into their history. Palmyra.
Well, I mean, the government could well have knocked these things down because it was the Tigray People's Liberation Party. They could have easily done something very wrong to the monuments if they'd wanted to, and they didn't. Largely, I think, because if they had done something, the government, they would have lost all the backing that they had.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, isn't it? Can't be seen to be those guys.
Something's a sacred.
They're very, very proud of their history, their tradition, and their, well, their freedom. You know, they were never colonized. Mm. You know, the second Solomonic dynasty goes back to 1270. And before that, the first Solomonic dynasty, of course, goes back to Menelik, son of Solomon and the Queen of Sheba, who, by the way, is Ethiopian, and her name is Makeda.
I didn't know that.
Ethiopian tradition says that. And it's the basis of the Solomonic dynasty and their right to rule. So, you know, you were asking about the Jewish connections. Well, there's one right there. And it's the basis of their right to rule. And of course, they've still got the Ark of the Covenant as well at Aksum. Nobody ever sees it apart from the keeper, and the keeper is appointed for life. But even the patriarch can't see it. But it's there, and it's again the basis of the church today, and it's been the basis of the church since it's been recorded.
Would you like to have a peek?
I hear
the deleterious effects are exaggerated.
No, not really. Yeah. I think largely because I think I would probably be disappointed. It's such a big part of the entire collective of Ethiopia. I don't think Ethiopians would want to see it either.
I'd be disappointed.
You know, the fact that it's hidden, the fact that it's there is sufficient.
Yeah, I don't think I'd want to see it.
No.
I want to keep my face on. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Happened in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Well, exactly.
This is it. This is it. We should not
want my face that melted.
Countries don't exist anymore.
Yeah, the next question I want to ask you is about something I guess we're sort of trying to highlight here a bit, but what do you think has been the important legacies of the Aksumite civilization?
It's the religions, I think, more than anything else. Mm. Apart, you know, of course, from the, you know, the historical importance of the place in the Ethiopian mind. As I said, Christianity, one of the earliest, they're very important there because their Christianity is quite different from everybody else's, more or less because it was cut off from everybody else's. And so it's developed its own idiosyncratic presentations, as, you know, every church does. I mean, well, the Ethiopia has got a very particular type, which is all its own, but also Islam. You've probably read about this, but if it hadn't been for the king of Aksum, Islam may not exist at all. Because he harbored the early refugees, even in 613, 615, even before the beginning of Islam in 622. He protected them. He refused to give them back to the Quraishi, who were the pagan rulers of the area around Mecca and Medina. The emissaries effectively described them as terrorists. They were refugees. And the king said, well, no, I'm not giving them back to you because they worship one God and so do I. And he gave them land in an area surprisingly called Nagash, like King Nagash. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they still live there. There's still a mosque there. And they still have the tombs of the original refugees there. And it is a place of veneration. Still today, it's a wonderful place.
Is there the earliest mosque there then?
It's the earliest mosque, and it's I don't know what, if any of them are any earlier, but it's certainly one of the earliest mosques in the world.
Yeah,
the building is modern, but you know there has been a mosque there since that time, and we're talking the beginning of the 7th century.
That's in its own subtle ways, it's had a huge impact on.
Absolutely. Considering what the Muslims were, you know, what they consisted of at that time, it's entirely possible that had they been sent back, as I said, they may have all been murdered or whatever, and you just simply wouldn't have Islam. There's plenty of sects that developed over the centuries and all sorts of religions that, you know, died. We never heard of them because they died because they didn't survive. Absolutely. And Islam may not have survived had the king said yes.
Yeah, and those other sects survived, we would be having a different conversation.
And it was said that Muhammad was supposed to remember the king of Aksum in his prayers. And basically early on it was sort of said to leave the Aksumite Empire alone.
In fact, according to the Quran, first Muzain, the guy who makes the call to prayer, was an Ethiopian.
Wow, okay. Ethiopians certainly have their fingers in a lot of historical pies, don't they? This is what we're learning.
Countries that don't exist anymore.
Yeah, the biggest legacy of the Aksum seems to be all the stele.
I'm sorry?
It's weird how they hang around, isn't it?
The fact that even after Christianity was adopted, they sort of held their place. Stele kept going,
They probably didn't produce any more, but they didn't knock them down either. Most of them fell, you know, over time. Some of them were deliberately toppled, and the largest stele, Stele 1, actually never was erected. Oh. At all. I mean, they tried, they failed, it fell during erection.
We've all been there.
But that, if you want another major contribution to the Aksumite world, Stele 1, that massive one that collapsed, it was the largest piece of stone, single piece of stone, anyone, anywhere tried to put up.
Wow.
It is 520 tons. And not only that, I mean, the standard practice is that you put it up and then you carve it, because otherwise you might damage it. Mm. Okay, well, Stele 1 is carved on all four sides and it was never erected.
So my
question is, and try and think about this, you know, I always tell this to people, and, you know, think about this for a second. How did they do the fourth side?
Well, they did three and then rolled it over.
520 tons.
Really, really big stick.
They're using matchsticks underneath. Yeah.
And the stone, we've got extraction quarries with some pieces that broke during extraction and whatever, but they're 4 kilometers away. So all this stuff was dragged at least 4 kilometers.
Poor elephants.
Yeah, imagine it's elephants.
You'd have to be.
Yeah. That's the usual interpretation, but we don't actually know. We assume rollers as well, but the wood there is not great wood, so they can't roll very far.
And I'll say it, since we're all thinking it, aliens.
Well, no, I don't know if Jackie's got a new documentary coming on the History Channel, which is almost like history, isn't it? It's just not really.
Stele 1, was it created by people? Or could it have been aliens?
Let's have 15 advert breaks and try and spin this out for as long as we can.
My brother used to watch, this is my brother in Canada, used to watch all those, you know, aliens, question programs.
Pyramids.
It was half an hour sort of ridiculous question. And, you know, he kept saying, no, you know, this is a possibility. And I said, if for once they would stop asking questions and start trying to answer them, I would start listening.
Yeah. But because then they just say, but is this a question that can be answered?
I know.
Countries that don't exist anymore.
Well, this seems like a really great time to start learning about Aksum and to really, get on the train, because there's a lot of stuff being dug up quite literally, and it will just completely change our understanding of the place. So you've just been great coming on, and we do these episodes all the time. We do some quite obscure little countries, national experiments that lasted for about a month, and then everyone got a bit bored of it. We very rarely dip into something like this, something quite so epic. Quite so strange that our podcast about obscure histories should probably feature one of the most important ancient and medieval empires. But here we are, and so
there we go.
It's just so great to learn a lot more about it, and it's also amazing to hear that there's new stuff being discovered and so much to come as well. So thank you so much for joining us,
and
thanks for answering our questions. That's been brilliant.
Yes, really, really amazing. Well, thank you very much for coming on to speak to us, Jackie. And we normally do at the end just to ask our guests if they have anything they would like to plug on the podcast. Any books coming out, any talks you've got coming up, anything you want people to buy?
Two books. This is one. Niall was with us at Aksum for 3 or 4 years. But this is a standard reference, General Archaeology of Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Niall Finneran. It's about, I think it's 2007. And the other one by David Philipson is, I'm looking at this thing. Can you see it?
Yep, got it.
There, which is
Foundations of an African Civilization.
Yeah.
David W. Philipson. Yeah, we'll put links in the page so you can go and buy them.
I mean, this is an old one, but it's also a general introduction, which is, this is written by Stuart Munro Hay, who was a language person more than an archaeologist, but he participated in the 70s in the excavations at Aksum. And I love his subtitle, which is An African Civilization of Late Antiquity.
Brilliant. Poetic.
Yeah, I mean, those are the three general books that are really worth reading.
Yeah.
So there, I mean, if you want more. English, there are others in other languages, but in English, those are the three that are...
So unless you fancy learning geese.
Cool. Well, anyway, those are some brilliant recommendations. Thank you. So
yeah,
we'll
have to
check those out.
Yeah.
And you can find the details of those recommendations via our website, ctdeapod.com.
And if anybody wants to go on a tour of Ethiopia, I do tours as well.
There we go. Now we should know about that then. So you're doing, tours of Ethiopia?
Well, not at the moment.
They're expensive, yeah. Unfortunately, but they are there.
Yeah. So if you are looking for an expensive but value-packed historical tour of Ethiopia, Jackie Phillips.
They're usually 2 weeks and they are literally a dash.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if you've got money to burn and history to learn, then
very good.
I mean, there's plenty of backpackers. If you want to live it on the cheap, you can do it whatever length of time you have.
Wow. Well, join us for our Countries That Don't Exist Anymore 2024 tour of Ethiopia. Yeah. Guest speaker, Jackie Phillips.
Yes. We'll be joined by some gap year students.
Countries That Don't Exist Anymore.
Well, that's bloody interesting, wasn't it?
It was. It was interesting, a lot interesting to find out about all this stuff because, apparently Wikipedia not full of information and sometimes...
Shocking.
Yes, and sometimes you really have to get this information, go straight to the horse's mouth.
Lovely horse it was. And also, you didn't see this because this is a podcast, but she had a lot of books in the background, so I felt very reassured.
Absolutely.
Of knowledge.
It's important to have lots of books.
Unless she was using a Zoom green screen.
Well, I did actually see on her, they had a Jeremy Clarkson's greatest things. So I don't know if she's quite on. No, not really. Really listeners.
The complete works of Dan Brown as well, which I was
Of Dan Brown. There was some Donna Tartt's, which I hear are better than you think. Yep. Just because she's called Tart.
Yeah, don't worry. It tastes good.
It was great to talk to her. It's really, obviously, we want to talk to experts like that.
Yeah.
That's all part of what we're doing as well. So if you have any, I don't know, I wasn't going to say, like, if you want us to talk to Timmy Mallett, we'll give it a go.
If you do want us to talk to Timmy Mallett, then please do hound him on Twitter. Is he still alive?
Timmy Mallett? No, he died after that. He couldn't get a word, just couldn't think of the word he was going for, and so he had to smack himself to death with a pink mallet.
Just to clarify, Timmy Mallet is not dead. Timmy Mallet is not dead. Unless, of course, he did mallet himself to death after the recording of this podcast, which is inadmissible in a court of law.
If you want to find out more about Aksum, you should really... go for the sources that Jackie Phillips has been talking about. There's some great places to start. I would advise, because if you go on YouTube, you type in Aksum. Now, there's a good Zainab Badawi documentary about it, but you will find some kooky ass conspiracy theories about how Africans don't know how to, set a VHS, let alone come up with an empire.
Build a steely.
Yeah, so, and we sort of touched upon that episode, but it's actually real, and it's 2020, and people are still peddling crazy stuff about how it must have all been done by...
Couldn't have been done by Africans.
Yes, exactly that.
So, next episode, what have we got coming up, Ed?
Good question, Phil. We're going over now to South America, back to South America.
Ooh.
We're going to modern Guyana, but was then one of England's first ever colonies called Willoughbyland. And so we will learn about the quick rise and even quicker fall of a colonial experiment that went a little bit wrong.
It's another silly one.
And there's death and stuff.
And there's lots of death.
Yes, maybe. And slavery. Yeah. But it's very silly.
Well, that's the main thing. Yes. We love to combine death and silliness. So join us next time. And as ever...
Look after yourself, because if you don't look after yourself, they might not.
Countries that don't exist anymore, they used to exist but not anymore. Now you know what this podcast is for, it's countries that don't exist.